Thank you so much for this opportunity. I have to say that it's a dream come true to be able to share my story in a women's venue. I say that I run the best run men's ministry, so it's nice to be able to be among kindred spirits. And it was always a dream of mine, and my 50th year, which is this year, has been quite an impressive year. My book came out, and not only did my book come out, but dreams have come true, and so this comes 2 weeks before my 51st birthday. So it's the last big dream for the year, and it's quite an amazing year. I wanted to start. Each of you have on your table a paper called Recapture Your Dreams. And as I'm going to share these, I'm assuming you can hear me, even though I don't have all the reverb going on, which is nice. And what I want to do is I want to share these, but as I'm sharing them, you can respond to any one of these questions. I'm going to open the floor up and just ask right now about, you know, if you have experienced any of these. But then after I share my story, we're going to come back to it. So the kind of the talk today is what are the road signs to your dream destination? Are the road signs in your life pointing towards your dream destination right now? What is a dream destination you have or had at one time envisioned for yourself? What roadblocks, dead ends, signs, impasses, or alternate route bypasses have put a death to your dream or caused you to lose your way? Has someone you know violated a no trespassing sign when you shared about your dream? Instead, they ignored the no hunting sign and shot and wounded or killed your dream by actions or words, causing you to put it into hiding, never to mention it again. Have you followed the directions of the map, God's word, and asked for directions in prayer, handing your dream shattered or unshattered over to God? If shattered, have you asked him to repurpose your dream for his divine plans? Or is there a danger falling rock sign nearby because you have become bitter towards God and everyone else, which explains the roadkill sign along the way? Or do you think your dream is good just like it is and you've decided you are on a one-way street? If God happens to come from the other direction, he will encounter a sign that reads, wrong way, keep out. What road sign best describes where you are right now on the road to your dream destination? What sign are you hoping to encounter next on your dream destination route? So I just want to open this up because just take a couple minutes to say, you know, where have you experienced any one of those things? The good, the bad, the roadkill? And if so, how? Or where are you? I think Fern leads us to the verse. And if you didn't get a chance now, you will get a chance at the end to share. And if some of you are saying, I don't have anything to share, I hope by the time we're done, you will have something to share. Listen to the dream destination promise from our Lord or in Scripture. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope in a future. Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. You may be discouraged that you wonder, what's the point of having a dream destination? Well, thank you. Well, I'm glad you asked, because Proverbs 29:18 gives the best explanation. Where there is no vision, the people perish. But he that keepeth the law, happy is he. In the Message Bible, it reads, if people can't see what God is doing, they stumble all over themselves. But when they attend to what he reveals, they are most blessed. Another verse is Psalm 119:1-2, and it says, Blessed are, this is NASB, blessed are those whose ways are blameless, who walk according to the law of the Lord. Blessed are those who keep his statutes and seek him with all their heart. Now the Message Bible says it this way. You're blessed when you stay on course, walking steadily on the road revealed by God. You're blessed when you follow his directions, doing your best to find him. That's right. You don't go off on your own. You walk straight along the road he set. You, God, prescribed the right way to live. Now you expect us to live it. Oh, that my steps might be steady, keeping to the course you set. Then I'd never have any regret in comparing my life with your counsel. I thank you for speaking straight from your heart. I learned the pattern of your righteous ways. I'm going to do what you tell me to do. Don't ever walk off and leave me. In this passage, we see we are blessed when we stay on course, but of course, in our human developmental stages, we are faced with difficult situations. Each one has temptations, growth, new life, new ideas, and also we contend with sin, knowingly or unknowingly commit it, and the effects of the sinful world on us hit us, and the results of the sins of others affect us, as well as our sins that affect other people. And sin can alter our perfect world dreams, and it happens in all kind of ways. They impact us, our social, emotional, mental, spiritual, and our physical lives through disabilities or obstacles or things we never bargained for or just life that, you know, overwhelms us. And these things can result in the death of dreams, loss, grief, and disappointment. And there we face challenges. We can either allow God to repurpose our dreams, or we can have all those falling rock signs where we become bitter and we destroy everybody that comes into our path, God first and everybody else. Or we can just say, put that keep out sign on our heart that says, God, you are not welcome any longer. And we grieve because of that. We lose out, but so does everybody else in our community, in our life, those we'd encounter. So I'm going to share my story. But as I start sharing my story, one thing about my story is it has some danger signs when people listen to it. One of the dangers is that all of us in this room, whether we're virgins, barren, or we have 100 children, we all have motherly instincts. Now, I want you to know, I believe each one of us was given one mother, right? And there's a reason God only gave us one, because two would have been one too many. And that's true for me, too. And so what often happens is people hear my story and they think they need to detour from their story to come and care for me. They're sitting there and they just can't wait until my story's done because they have the next best option for me. From a garbage man to financial investor becomes the best doctor I've never met. So I want to say that my story, it can be a danger zone because I'm not looking for you to come up to me afterwards, even though I know you mean well. I'm not looking for anybody to come up to me afterwards and give me the next treatment option I should be taking. The other thing that happens is that it detours you from being able to be where God wants you to be right now. And that's in your own story. Not meddling in how to fix me. But that's our maternal instinct. I understand that. I know it's all out of goodness. And the other thing is, if you want to pray for me afterwards, would you do me a favor and put me on your everyday prayer list? And in a month, write me and tell me that you have prayed every day for me. That will do so, and you can pray unceasingly for my difficulties. But please, do me a favor. Don't come up afterwards and ask to pray for me right then. God is doing amazing things in my life. He's healed me in a zillion ways. But I'm like you, and I'm still broke. But God is going to fix me in his ways. So I say that with the greatest amount of gratitude to you for caring for me. But please, this is about what God wants to do in each of our lives. So let me start. Sometimes there's billboards in our lives. Fern shared one. Susan shared the billboards in her life. My billboard is this necklace. When I was 16, my twin brother gave it to me, and with it he gave me a promise. When I get rich, I'll buy you a bicycle store. Now, if you've ever had twins or you are a twin, twins don't want the other person to know everything about them, but they began knowing everything about them. So that's a lifetime that we spend trying to undo that. And so when my brother said that to me, I thought, how dare you say a dream that I have never put words to? But he was right. And I spent many years, decades, trying to push that dream out because it sounded too good to be true, and I didn't know how it would ever happen. And but one thing you need to be cautioned about is that when you have a dream, oftentimes your passion becomes your fashion. So this morning I wanted to put pearls on, but I couldn't. I needed to put my bicycle on. So it's part of my my work attire, I guess you could call it, speaking. But also, if you look too close at this pair of pants, you will find grease on it. And that's another one of my passions that always becomes my fashion, even when I am trying to dress up and be taken out somewhere. So I don't know what your passion is, but maybe you can even look and see if it's part of your fashion. And these are just some clues of what, how to recapture our dream. Or if you're saying, boy, I'm here, but I don't have any idea what my dream is. These are just some ways of saying, hey, think about that. And I'm trying to use those road signs so that we can kind of use that analogy. By the age of 30, I had biked on 4 continents. I'd crossed the United States twice, and my goal was to bike on all 7 continents and through all 50 states. And I had biked through 30 of them, 10,000 miles, across the United States when I was 15 and 16. Another one of those things is, your mother really let you do that? So that God gave me the right mother. In 1992, I was on a superhighway to my dream destination and speeding beyond the speed limit. I know none of you ever speed, but sometimes I do. And it seemed like all the road signs were pointing in the right direction. And the green lights, I was hitting them. Even in Illinois, I was hitting them one after the other. And then 4 days before going on a 1,000-mile bike trip, a 10-day, 1,000-mile bike trip, which was going to be a 2.5-week interview, and I was going to leave my position as a home health nurse at Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's, where I was making good money, and I was going to leave that and move to a small town of Upland, Indiana, in the cornfields. All they have there is Ivanhoe's. It's an ice cream joint. I do like ice cream, though. And I woke up with the flu. Now, I'm a nurse, so I figure, well, no problem. The trip's in 4 days. Flu lasts 24 hours, right? Well, that's what I had hoped. So there I was. The days passed, 4 days passed. I had to cancel the trip, my 2.5-week interview. A month passed. I'm getting worse. I'm on pain medications that equivalent to every 4 hours, codeine 3, which is the top codeine you could have, and in between that, anti-inflammatories, and just to keep the pain, and who knew what the pain was from. Of course, the worst comes to mind. Maybe it's cancer, and then your eyes start doing some tricks, and you see bulges here and there. You forgot that you had just had ice cream the night before, and you think it's tumor. And so anyways, there
after a couple of days of being sick, I had to remember the scenic outlook signs from my past. And one was in 1988, 4 years prior I'd gone to Israel. And while in Israel, I rededicated my life to the Lord in the Jordan. And I remember saying, Lord, wherever you want, we'll go. And then carrying my bike up Masada on my shoulder, the top of Masada is where 920 Jews committed suicide because the Romans were coming after them. And now the military cadets take an oath there, never forget, never again. And my oath was, God, I will never forget you, never again. So I like to ask, you know, what are those scenic outlook signs in your life? And have you kind of put a stake in the ground for God for, you know, when the road gets rough? Because unless we have something we're looking to that we're going for, I don't know about you, but sometimes we turn around, make a U-turn and go back home, and we forget about where we're supposed to be headed. And so, you know, when I went to Israel, I had the falling rock sign up on my life, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to go with God anymore. I mean, matter of fact, I'd come to the point of saying, God, I don't think you're worth going with anymore. And I'd grown up in a Christian home, and so by that point, I mean, what's the option if you're not going to go with God? But I'm not a quitter, so I kept on to that thought for several months, and then I got to do my dream, one of my dream destinations, to bike through Israel. And, you know, there I set that spiritual landmarker. And we all need a spiritual landmarker in our lives. If you haven't set it, figure out where it is and set one with God. And when I returned from Israel, what struck me while I was in Israel was prayer, the Wailing Wall. People from all walks of life are there praying, many to a God they don't even believe in. They'd walk away from it and say, do you believe in God? No. But every day they walk to the Wailing Wall to wail and pray, and I was just struck. And then I got to the Garden of Gethsemane, and out in front of the Garden of Gethsemane was a camel to go take camel rides. Here we had the option to enter into Christ's suffering or to do the ultimately ridiculous of going on a camel ride. I won't tell you which I picked, but I am human. And so I did not pick suffering. Instead, there's this little Arabic guy who's just patting his pocket with these dumb Americans taking this 50-yard camel ride. But isn't that what we all do if we have the opportunity to enter the prayer garden of suffering or jump on the camel and go for a 50-yard camel ride? I think most of you would have joined me. But I was struck that why did Jesus suffer? Because it was through suffering that he came to know the Lord. And that's, we in America want to so skirt suffering, but it's part of the journey. So then I came home and I heard a sermon by Pastor Lutzer. Can you not pray with me 1 hour? So, you know, we've all had those sermons where we run home and try and institute what we have heard. So I ran home to institute my 1 hour a day prayer routine. Anyways, maybe you can interpret that. So I kneel down at the side of my bed and I go through my laundry list and then my food list and my garbage list. And guess what? There's still 58 minutes left in the hour. And let me tell you, that hour was, yes, I made it. All I can tell you about that hour was maybe that was one of those spiritual landmarks, too. That Satan and I battled. I can't tell you anything more significant came out of it other than I realized I needed to reevaluate my goal and realize it was a little beyond what my spiritual muscles could handle. And so I decided, well, I can't, there's no way I can pray an hour a day. I don't even know how to do it. And it's not going to lead to success right now. So I decided one uninterrupted hour a week. But, you know, I don't know how many hours are in a week, 800 or something. And so, you know, the around 800 and one or two, I started thinking, I better start thinking when my hour of prayer is going to be for this week, because I'm going to, the week's going to pass. And you would think, well, certainly you're single. You have an hour in your week that you can devote to prayer. You don't have any kids. You don't make sure that your husband has gotten to work, da-da-da-da-da. You're sick. You don't work. So you certainly have an hour. I mean, don't you have 24 hours in your day? And I only have, I don't know. Many people come and say that I have more time in my day, so I don't know what your day has, but mine has 24 hours. And but, you know, prayer, there's never time to pray. But we can always find a way out of prayer. And it doesn't have to be anything dramatic. It can be the camel ride. But we'll always take the out from prayer. And so for 4 years, I prayed one uninterrupted hour a week. And when I got sick after about 2 days, I thought, I don't know how long this is going to go on. I have no idea what it is. But maybe now's the time that I pray one uninterrupted hour a day. And, you know, it was, I needed to seek directions. You know, on our road signs, we need directions. I seemed to be at a crash scene was starting to prevail, and I was, the path was beginning to look impassable for me. And now the road sign had a road closed sign, and I didn't know what I was going to do. My dream was now dashed to go, and, you know, I thought working for this bike group that I had done some of my cycling with was the way that God was going to redeem my bicycle shop. And so I thought, how can a life of productivity and production and being a citizen who is, you know, when you're a working member of society, you're seen as someone of importance. How could being disabled and prayer becoming my number one occupation be more important than what all of society touts as important? I didn't get it. But I decided I was going to be faithful and pray an hour a day. And prayer became my number one occupation. And there were hopeless times. And there were times I went through two cancer scares. And I planned my funeral. Nobody else was with me when I did that, because nobody ever wants to plan someone's 30th funeral, you know, funeral when they're 30 with someone. But that's how old I was. I was 30. And I spent thousands of dollars of medical bills, in medical bills. My, you know, what was once a social calendar consisted of going to doctors. I saw 19 different specialists, and they did all their tests on me. And and in the end, I had gone to my doctor thinking, waiting to hear if I had cancer of, I think it was cancer of my SI joint. And of course, I saw this big bulge here. And like I said earlier, I forgot to take into account the ice cream I had had the night before. And so I had was certain that was a tumor when it wasn't. It's still there. It's grown a little. but anyways, I walked in, and someone was supposed to have called me. But of course, I was nobody was caring about me after I walked out and paid my bill to return my call. But the doctor said, no, it's not cancer. And she looked at me and she said, it's chronic fatigue syndrome. And she had just read me my life sentence and thrown away the key. As a nurse, I knew that syndrome is kind of like a garbage diagnosis. If you don't know what it is, call it that. And I had things, I'm sitting right now because for me to stand in that this has been, is being treated or is under control, for me to stand for 30 seconds, my heart rate would go from 60 to 180 standing still. Took 10 years for them to figure out what it was. And of course, in the process, they kind of dumbed down my heart rate so far that I couldn't even get out of bed because it was too far for me. I have my 7-year-old car has 32,000 miles on it. That gives you an idea of how often I drive, and that's because excuse me. And that's because I have delayed reaction time. If I start losing my mental faculties, I cannot take in the side-to-side things. I'm an athlete, or was an athlete, but if I exercise at a quarter of what I once did, I can have a 42 to a 72-hour relapse. It can leave me in bed for that length of time. The only strength I have today is what Paul said. In his weakness, he is strong. And I might look great. My best friend, Jen, who, if you've read the book, this is Jen from the book. Jen will tell you the real story of what today is, but don't ask her until afterwards. So this went on from 1992 to 2003, and I missed whole seasons. Maybe got out of the house once or twice in the season, and you know, that was a hopeless feeling. I had no idea. You know, to be honest, I would have rather had cancer because, first off, sometimes cancer is a little bit more glamorous of an illness. I'm not downplaying anybody who has cancer. Please hear that. But chronic fatigue syndrome was known as shirker syndrome. In other words, hey, if you don't want to work, well, you're just shirking your responsibility. Now, who would leave a professional position as a member of society, a recognizable member of society, to become disabled? I mean, there wasn't any million-dollar pots that I was reaching into when that happened. And Shirker syndrome, or the other one was yuppie syndrome. Well, you know, I mean, I just, or it's all in your head syndrome. You know, I mean, you know, they're funny. They're almost comical. But can you imagine? You know, at least cancer, the other thing is there's treatment, right? So either that treatment works, or for many of us, we know where we're headed. And so heaven's a better option than living here sick every day. But to wake up for the last 20 years sick every day, that's a hard way to live life. So in 2000, I was getting ready to sell my bike. I hadn't told anybody this, but I bought a $1,200 bike to start leading these cross-country trips that I was going to on this 2.5-week interview for. And I think that's where we need carpooling signs. We don't do the road of life alone. We need friends who share the road with us. And I hadn't told anybody about this because I didn't think it mattered what I was going to do with my bike. It was my own possession. I live alone. Who was I responsible to report that to? But I happened to have a big mouth, and I was sharing it one day with Jen. And Jen said, Alice, you can't sell your bike, because if you sell your bike, what that means is you're giving up hope. She said, I know you don't need the money that bike's going to bring in, but you cannot do it. Whatever you do, you've got to keep your bike. Well, my bike was just, I didn't realize it, but she was right. My bike, if I had sold my bike, I was giving up hope. Couldn't ride it much, maybe put on, in the last 10 years, 100 miles on my bike if I'm lucky. But It had nothing to do with that. And then in 2003, I hit an all-consuming pothole, a Chicago pothole, where the whole car falls in. And I lost my disability insurance. And of course, because to all of you, I'm the, you know, picture of health. I've got some really rosy cheeks, and it might be even traveling down here, and I didn't need blush this morning, and I'm not blushing at you, but it's a little warm in this room, and I'm allergic to rooms that are above 68 degrees. So all the signs that look good to you are probably not that to me. And so they came out and did a private investigation. They followed me with a private eye camera. And I lost my disability insurance. And at that point, I was living on what I could make, $450 a month, working as an assistant in a dental office, my cousin's dental office here in Glen Ellyn. And, you know, sometimes I'd show up, sometimes I couldn't. I tried to be as responsible of adult as I was, and I, of course, didn't have a role that you depended on me, because the only thing that's dependable about me is being undependable. And I was never that way. I mean, since junior high, I've carried a calendar every year. My dad's got me a calendar, but I cancel more appointments than I keep these days. Then, 6 months after I lost my insurance, there was a green light, and I was to proceed with caution. But I want you to know that all I wanted to do was turn around and go the other way, or ignore the direction sign. I was close to getting lost heading the wrong way. When I was with a couple, the Governsons, some of you know them, and I had been asked to join them for dinner, and they had a couple from Tanzania over. Now, maybe you're saying hospitality is one of my gifts. This story that I'm going to tell you now couldn't have gone on without the gift of the Governsons, the hospitality of a meal, and to enjoy it with a couple from Tanzania. And I really got along well with husband, John Lutenbecka. Carolyn didn't speak too much English, so we got along, but we couldn't communicate. So, and I went home that night, and I felt God challenging me to have them over. Now, sometimes people say, does God talk to you in your prayers? Well, you know, we're always talking to ourselves, right? We know who we are. Oh, you don't look right. You got ugly hair. Your feet are too big. Right? We know those voices, right? I mean, maybe you don't have them. Sorry, those are my voices. You got your own. But they don't sound much different, I don't think. So we know that 90%, we know what those voices are, right? So we can just 90%, that's me, that's Satan bugging me. So, you know, those other times when things come, wouldn't this be a good idea if I tried this? Well, maybe just think, oh, I wonder if God is challenging me to do that. Okay, so we know 99% is us. So maybe half of that 1% might be God. So 50% you can be right, and you too can say God has spoken to you, okay? Sometimes it's that still small, oh, maybe I should invite that person over. Oh, let's go out for coffee. So that's the way I felt God spoke to me. I just felt this nudging to have this couple over. And I said, you know what, God, I don't have anything to offer this couple. I mean, after all, my living is gone. I live alone. I own my own home. I'm living off $450 a month. And now you want me to invite this couple over? What do you think I have to offer them? And, of course, I'm still somewhat plummeted into a deep depression from not knowing if I'm going to have to move to Detroit back into mommy and daddy's home at 40-some years old, and that's just not sitting real well with me. And but the volume started getting louder and louder. Have them over every week. Have them. Don't you get it? You know, so we're having this conversation, so now I'm talking to this voice that's talking to me, and now Okay, well, anyways. So, finally, 3 months later, I thought, okay. I went to church that day just to return some library books. I wasn't going to stay. I didn't feel good. And who do I see? Carolyn Lutenbecka. 2 weeks before Christmas, and I said, hey, Carolyn, what are you and John doing for dinner tonight? Would you like to come over? Yes, we'd love to come over. Well, I didn't make it through the service. I had to go home to bed. I was too sick to sit through the service. Now, that's not usually how women like to entertain. First off, they like to make sure there's some good food, just like we had, that nice of a spread. And I never put on quite that nice of a spread, but so we like a good spread. We want to make sure there's food prepared. Let's not talk about the house being clean, but but where did I go? I went home to bed. And if I was going to entertain, I had to go to bed for about 3 hours. And there wasn't much in my fridge, but our African brothers and sisters are very forgiving. If you've got tea with a little milk and sugar, you're good. And, you know, everything else is gravy to them. They have a lot to teach us about hospitality. They really are just looking for fellowship. So they came in, and they looked and said, wow, where'd you get your firewood? I said, well, I pray for it. Wow, how much do you pay for rent? Well, I own my home. Well, how much is your mortgage? I said, well, I don't have a mortgage. God challenged me to pay my house off a few years ago, 6 months after I bought it. Wow, you're a woman of faith. So we went on and talked, and I asked them, how could our church help your ministry? And they said, if every family in the church gave a $100 gift, each $100 gift would buy a bicycle, allowing a pastor or evangelist to travel to a 5-hour walk distance from five villages that are 5 hours from each other. So they'd save time and they'd be doing ministry. So I took them home. They said a lot of other things, but I don't have any other idea what they said because they didn't know anything about my cycling. I didn't have wasn't wearing my passion at the time. But there was a bike in front of my house, and so when we left, they said, oh, is that the bike you use? Now it's bent, doesn't move, it's just a tree ornament. And I came home, and God challenged me to give the cost of my road bike, $1,200. I was only making $450 a month. I didn't know when I'd make any more. And here we are in a little bit of a tussle, I guess is the word, that God and I had. And so he challenged me. The challenge was, will you obey me? And that was the challenge. And so after 3 hours, he won, but I did too. I gave the $1,200. They bought 10 bikes in Tanzania. It was the best Christmas present I could have ever given myself or them. And within a week, I came home that day, and there was a $200 check in the mail and says, thank you for helping us in our time of need. We'd like to help you. My pastor had called from the church. I go to Wheaton E-Free, and said, we heard this had been a bad year. Can we help you? They paid for the only bill coming up, my next 6 month car insurance. And by the end of the week, someone had given me a $1,000 check for something else that I needed. Nobody knew. You know, of course I said I'd gotten bikes, but I mean, can you imagine the financial counselors that would have circled the building to tell me how crazy I was to have given, you know, $1,200 away. And so the next year, sometimes when we follow our dreams, there's steep hills that we have to climb. Beware, steep hill signs are ahead of us. But don't worry, the steep hills are accompanied by some awesome coasts on the other side. But first, we got to climb the hill. And then sometimes there's swerving roads ahead signs. So I went on for another year, still $450, not knowing if I'd make any more. And I met a couple from Nigeria, missionaries to Nigeria. And afterwards, God challenged me to give the cost of my road bike again. My goal now was to give away 100 bikes in my lifetime. And I gave them money, $1,200, and they asked if they could buy five hand-pedaled bicycles for those who were affected by landmines, polio, or other disabilities? I said, sure. And they sent me the picture, and my mentor, who had prayed for me for 10 years, was a member of this church for a long time, Robert Walker. And Robert Walker, if you know Robert Walker, the late Robert Walker, he helped found many organizations. One of the first he helped found was Pioneer Girls. And Louise Traub, who's one of the co-founders of Pioneer Girls, is a mentor of mine also, was a nursing school instructor of Jen and mine. And I was the bookend. His Wheels, the organization I founded, was his other bookend of what he helped start. And we were all in a Bible study together. So he said to me, Alice, this dream is bigger than any organization I helped begin. At the time, it was the International Fellowship of Christian and Jews, and their budget was $52 million. Well, don't get too excited about that. Might be the biggest, but money isn't the biggest number one thing we have going. But anyways, so he challenged me to start an organization. And one of his magazines was His. And I was sitting in a Bible study one day, and I looked and I thought, here's a word genius. And he named a magazine His. And I thought, His, wow. And so I was going to go with His Wheels. That was taken at the time. So I thought, now I have to add another word. I'll add Africa, because international seemed a little too intimidating. But this missionary from Nigeria said, Africa, don't limit God to Africa. Do international. So from there, that billboard returned. My dream destination was ahead. His Wheels International. I waited so long, and I wasn't sure I wanted it now. And, you know, I faced all these green lights for the next 2 years. Within 4 months, found out that people around the world needed hand-pedaled trikes. I thought I'd take a welding class, learn how to weld, and then I could build trikes. Didn't need anything else but to learn how to weld, build trikes. A month later, I was at a party. I met a guy. He said, I'm a mechanical engineer. Can I design, build, and pay for the prototyping? He's now designed 22 different trikes. We've gone from getting bikes to people, and we've gotten bikes to people affiliated with 90 countries on 6 continents. So they're either immigrants, missionaries, refugees, international students. We've worked with Dominata, with the Eastern European group, for many years, providing bikes in the summer for them. We've gotten 165 bikes to 12 countries overseas. But our trike is on 5 continents and Vanuatu. Vanuatu is off of Australia, so if you want to count that as another continent, it would be the Australia continent. So we have 60 of these around the country and our goal, or the world, and our goal is that they will start building them in different parts of the world. And we have in India with Spring Arbor University, they have just finished building 10, and they plan to distribute them to a leprosy and people from a leprosy compound in the next 2 weeks. They're being built by a vocational school to the Dalit group, which are below the caste system. Yesterday I was in the city for Spring Arbor, competed in a huge Enactus business club, and what did they present but how to keep the trikes self-sustaining in India. And they even want to find a college group that has an Enactus program in India to help with that project. I'm going to be skipping most of this, but that's where then you are forced to take a look at the book. Okay, but in 2009, I was on a... all these great things had happened, but when you have a health condition, you can't push the ball up the hill, as Dave says he loves to do, push the ball up the hill. Instead, you have to listen to God, and that's not saying that he does not listen to God. That's not the point I'm making. But you have to listen, and when God says stop, you don't have any choice but to stop. Either it's your health or you stop. And I had stopped 1 year for 15 weeks throughout the year. And here I am, an executive director of a growing organization. On one of my trips home, I heard a lawyer sitting next to me said, "Oh, you got to read the book Outliers." It talks about, and the whole premise of the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell is it takes 10,000 hours to make a prodigy. Well, I have a nephew who's 13, and he just started U of M when he was 12, and I thought I was reading this book for my 12-year-old nephew's sake. But I read about a chapter, and I went to prayer, and God challenged me to pray 10K, 10,000 hours, and I thought, Lord, how many hours are in a day, a week, a month, a year? They're going to take forever. But I began this pray 10,000 hour journey in 2009. And then I recognized that, you know, really I'd started it in 1988. And in the fall of 2012, I finished my first pray 10K. What I learned is I will never become a prayer prodigy. We can never plummet the depths of prayer or the heights. But I can tell you that it has been a scenic outlook to learning to walk in a spacious place. Living out our dreams, prayer can both take the breath away from us and it can be a breathtaking experience. And sometimes our dreams have to go through suffering first. Those who suffer, he delivers in their suffering. He speaks to them in their affliction. He is wooing you from the jaws of distress to a spacious place, free from restriction, to the comfort of your table laden with choice food. That's Job 36, 15 and 16. They comforted me in the day of my disaster, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a spacious place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. The Lord has dealt with me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has rewarded me. That's Psalms 18, 18 to 20. I don't know if we know how to live in a spacious place because we're so used to living bound by things. And as I look back at the roadmap to, let me put it this way, looking back at the roadmap to your dream destination, can you see that indeed all things work together for good? Even if you're in that bad place, for me, I can look back and see that every stop, detour, dead end was part of traveling toward and embracing my dream destination that is filled with exhilaration, fear, joy, sorrow, yet worth it all. And we must travel to our deep dream destination. In God's economy, our dream destination is important for the entire body of Christ. Other people's dreams are dependent on us obediently following God's roadmap for our lives to help them find the way to their dream destination. So I want to ask again, what road sign would best describe where you are on the road to your dream destination? Maybe one I mentioned or one you thought about while I was talking. And what sign are you hoping to encounter next on your dream destination route? Yeah.
I read the book also. Can you just tell them about your bicycle shop?
Yeah. We have a bike shop in on Hill Avenue in unincorporated Glen Ellen. We moved in 2010, and it was just amazing. My brother and nephew came, and I said to my brother, "How'd you do on your bicycle shop?" And he just looked at me and said, "I don't think I did it." And one of my Jewish, the guy that challenged me in Israel with my faith, and I didn't share that story, but he's on our board, and he said, "This is a spiritual bike store." And we have bikes and hand-pedaled trikes. We've delivered over 1,600 bikes and hand-pedaled trikes. And Just like someone shared, Christy shared about Fern, I look forward to getting to heaven and hearing people say, you provided a bike for me. Instead of waving to me, saying, I waved to you when you passed me in my country, to know that they used a bike that somehow came through the hands of our organization. Anybody else? Questions, comments, or wisecracks, or if you want to answer, not too many wisecracks, but if you want to answer, you know, one of these questions, maybe what's jogged your memory, because some great comments before, and yeah.
What if you don't have a dream? Or, you know, you haven't, it hasn't occurred to you yet.
Yeah. Well, that's why, in some of the ways, you know, I was joking earlier about, you know, I think of the story of Moses. Wasn't it Moses who God said, what's in your hand? You know, what's in your hand? I want you to use what's in your hand. And, you know, Moses probably was thinking, what's in my hand? You know, right now, it's kind of like you could ask me, what's in your hand? What do you mean, what's in my hand? I don't know what's in my hand. Oh, a bike's in my hand. The other thing is, I think that's where sometimes we need carpooling. You know, without my friend Jen to have said, you can't sell your bike, you're giving up hope. I had people who had told me, get over the bike. You know, you can't ride it. That's in your past. Bicycles were in my dreams. They were in my nightmares. They were the way I analyze life. I can think through. I see bike go by, and my friends always laugh at me because that's what happens to my neck. It's good I've not been in any accidents. Sorry, officer. No, I wasn't texting. I was looking to see if our his wheel sign was on that bike. I think that's where community comes in. You know, who could you gather with? You know, just that I could have let Fern continue talking this morning because she shared something that you needed more than to hear me, someone within your own body, and how God had used her, and maybe you have some more discussions. These are some great questions, and sometimes it's those things. Hey, you're really good at that. What do we usually say to that? Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. If I sound like my mother, there's a reason. I learned it from my mother. I'm afraid some of you learned it from your mothers, and your offsprings probably can say the same about where they learned it from. But sometimes we poo-poo what God has asked us to embrace. And we do it because, well, we're not supposed to be proud, and we're not supposed to show off what we've done. But you know what? We need to hear a story like Fern's. We need to hear a story. You know, I don't quite reach the accolades that I received before we started. I'm human. I will go home and crash. Tonight, after my friend leaves, she'll get a call, and I'll be in tears because I'm a terrible person. I'm as human as you are. I do not embrace the 24, 48, 72, or 3-week time that my door is closed and nobody comes in and nobody goes out. I am an extrovert. I am not an introvert. Those are hard times for me. But it's in that the rough of the diamond has been smooth just a tad, not too smooth. I'll let my twin tell you how unsmooth it is, but... I don't know if that was helpful. I know it's not easy, especially when someone, you know, feels they've found everything that they ever wanted in life. But, you know, everything in life hasn't come my way. I live off of $1,000 a month in Wheaton alone. You probably know that doesn't get you too much. But it's interesting how many people are jealous and would like my life. I'm not sure which piece they want of it. I don't know if they want the whole thing or if they just want to pick and choose. I'm still disabled. I'm still referred to by many as shirkers. I had someone tell me a couple weeks ago who invited me over for dinner three times, and I had to cancel that after three times you're out. But, oh, just joking. So, you know, it's not easy. It sounds glamorous when I stand here and talk, but I am not glamour, glitz and glamour. I don't have any on. So, anybody else?
Tell you a little bit about dreams in their lives that have been squashed, or maybe this just opens a hole.
Yeah, I shared this. I was teaching this semester in his human development. He's filling in for the human development class. And I had a 20-year-old guy say beforehand, I don't have any dreams. You know, wow. Think of a 20-year-old who's already had all their dreams curtailed. And he came up to me afterwards and he said to me, you know, my father, my maybe not an existing father, I mean a father who's not a part of the life, my mother died. I have two younger siblings. I'm an undergraduate, and God challenged me to go bring them back, get them from Mississippi or somewhere south, and bring them back and be the father and the brother to these children. He said, I didn't want to do that. I where was I going to live? What was I going to do? He said, but I listened to God, and I went down and I talked to my aunt or grandmother or whoever, told them, and she said, okay, but I'm not helping you at all out at all, and I was getting ready to put your siblings into foster care. If you're going to take those kids, you're going to have to do it all alone. You have a month to do it. You have to pack up all your mother's stuff and move back up to Illinois. He didn't know where he was going to live. He got a call from someone at the school, and there was an open house on campus. They knew what had happened. He went in there. Now, he's saying he's not living his dream out. Now, he is living his dream. It's just not as glamorous as we think the dream is. Dreams are not necessarily glamorous. And if you want to know how unglamorous a dream is, we just celebrated Easter Sunday. And how about Christ and his dream? What did he pay for his dream? And we have to ask sometimes, are we willing to pay the cost of our dream? And that's why I started by the danger signs. Isn't it much easier to look at me and say, well, Alice, you know, you need to try this treatment and that treatment and this treatment and that treatment. How about saying to yourself, Alice, you need to be willing to spend $1,200 to go for your dream. You can't get rid of your bike because if you get rid of your bike, you're giving up hope. Well, I didn't really want to listen to that. But sometimes if we're going to carpool with friends, there's a trick. And the trick is we have to be willing to listen to what they recommend. We can't just say, you're my best friend, but stay out of that area. You know, are we going to listen when they say you can't sell your bike? Or whatever. Yeah, and I so agree. And, you know, for me, I'm single. I've been single all my life. And how about the baby I wanted to hold? But how about the babies I have right now? It looks a little different than your baby, but probably no two babies in this room ever look the same. and maybe it's a baby that looks like this. And maybe I was single so that I could run the best run men's ministry and my husband wouldn't be jealous of all the men that want to come out and use their hobbies.